What is up, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Uncanny, the unofficial X-Men 97 podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Condon, and today we're going to be going over this interesting kind of two-part, like, episode going on where you have essentially two stories overlapping in one episode. We have Motendo, and then we have another kind of vignette coming about maybe 17, 18 minutes into the runtime of the episode that's called Life Death Part 1. So we have two very different stories, two very different animation styles, two very different emotional themes in this one episode, where it's really two episodes. It's a little confusing. I think, you know, a lot of these newer episodes in this series are trying to condense a lot of information in a very brief time window because the stories that they're trying to tell require a lot of exposition. But they're also trying to throw in some fun stuff and some continuity with individual characters. So before we get into the whole why are they sticking two stories into one episode and rushing both, in lieu of actually developing a long-form, deep episode, we have two very different stories involving very different character sets in this episode. So I guess first we're going to have to go into the first one, which is Motendo. Funny play on Nintendo, no relation, and Mojo. So we, you know, again, we're going to get into spoilers. There's no way I can't spoil a lot of this episode because it's so dense and because there is really no breathing room outside from the plot. So I'm going to spoil it. One, two, three. Okay, cool. So you watched the episode Motendo Life Death Part 1. We're going to get into it. So we see the Xavier Mansion with Magneto, Rogue, Gambit, and the rest waiting to celebrate, that's right, Jubilation Lee or Jubilee's 18th birthday. Wow, I thought she was already 18 in the original series. I guess I was wrong. So she's turning 18, and what does she want to do? Well, any 18-year-old in the late 90s is going to want to go to an arcade, which, that's kind of what I did. I'd love going to the arcade. I still go to arcades, but, you know, they're barcades, and you drink and feel sad. I digress. So we see Jubilation Lee kind of reacting to this new father figure in lieu of the nicer, friendlier, more, I guess, effervescent Xavier with Magneto, who is, you know, Magneto. He's kind of a stick in the mud. He's, you know, got his chips on both shoulders, so to speak. And it's pretty apparent that, you know, some of the more fun and happy-go-lucky X-Men are not finding a home with this guy. Aside from Rogue, who I'm assuming he's sleeping with, which, you know, creepy. But anywho, so Jubilation Lee is ticked. She's like, what gives? Why can't I just, you know, have a little bit of fun? It's my friggin' birthday. Cupcakes are nice, but I want to go out. I want to do something. We've all been there. We're all, you know, young people and want to go and have fun. And our parents or guardians are like, no, you're not going anywhere because the world is scary. It doesn't really keep. So Jubilation Lee is ticked off, and she's in her dorm room, and who else is in the dorm room but Roberto da Costa? And it looks like these two are being set up for some kind of romantic connection, which I don't think is a bad idea. I mean, Jubilation Lee was a character that was debuted by Chris Claremont and other developers in the late 80s and early 90s, but it was really the TV show that really brought her into the public light. However, Roberto was a character who was a part of the New Mutants who came in like the fourth iteration of the X-Men team. So Roberto, you know, is kind of like the comic book character that was really not brought to the animation forefront. Along with other new mutants like Ileana Rasputin or Magic, you had Rian Sinclair or Rain Sinclair, who was Wolfsbane. All these other really cool characters that, you know, there's been some attempts to bring them to the screen. There were other X-Men animation properties that brought the characters in kind of on one-offs, but they were never really mainstays within their own contiguous, you know, show. And Sunspot, or Roberto, is a great character. And, you know, we're getting to see him open up a little bit about his powers, but obviously he has his reservations, so to speak. He is having a difficult time coming out of the closet as a mutant. I think they're making that allegory very, very honestly here about being in hiding. And what does it mean when you're hiding a part of your identity? How does that influence who you are or how you handle yourself? Or in Roberto's case, what airs are you putting on in order to seem as though you're doing great? When in reality, Roberto is suffering because he's, you know, denying a part of his identity as being a mutant. So we see in the episode, in the first part, in Motendo, that Jubilation Lee is stuck at home and, you know what, I'm just going to play video games with my friends. Hey, haven't we all done that? And I love how the Motendo actually almost kind of looks like a Sega Genesis. And there's a reason for that, that it doesn't look like a Nintendo, because there was an X-Men game that came out for the Sega Genesis that did have a very similar design for the sleeve of the game. So if you're looking at the game that's next to this, you know, I'm assuming it's a VCR TV, looks like it has a tape deck or a VCR, the game itself does look like a Sega Genesis cartridge. And the design of the game in the cartridge looks like the X-Men game for Sega Genesis. Again, X-Men were always a part of the gaming industry. There are so many Easter eggs in this about X-Men video games, even like that it says 16-bit on the little tendrils that come out and grab Roberto and then Jubilee. Again, 16-bit, Sega Genesis was a 16-bit system. Right? Pretty cool. May have been 32. I have to look into that. But I know N64 is obviously 64. But I believe Sega Genesis and then the Sega Dream, what was it, Game Gear, was also a 16-bit system. So they're sucked into a video game. Whoa, how cool is that? Almost very Matrix-like. Matrix, right? When did that come out as a film? You know, I think 2000, maybe late 90s. I gotta, you know, do some research, but I believe that's the case. We're ushered right into some very, very, you know, nostalgic-looking Sentinels and a very nostalgic-looking landscape, very similar to some of the landscape that you see in the OG X-Men arcade game, which is referenced constantly in this vignette, which I love. There's literally a barcade in downtown Syracuse where I live that has this game. It's great. And the X-Men arcade game actually came out in support of an animation that they piloted, that Marvel piloted, called Pride of the X-Men. It really never got greenlit after one-off, but it was great. It had Cyclops, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Storm, Wolverine. And it was about Kitty Pryde, who was a Jewish girl who could shift and phase through walls, and about her realizing that she's a mutant and going on an adventure with the X-Men. So, it, you know, Pride of the X-Men really didn't go anywhere aside from being like a one-off. And then the show, this, you know, that this 97 reboot is based on, is what came about from that. That was like a new iteration with new characters and with Jubilee, as opposed to Shadow Cat, who was Kitty Pryde. So Asian American versus Jewish American. Both representations of a minority class. So again, that's just some history for you there. But yes, we see some scenes that are very evocative of that early 90s arcade game where you had four playable characters simultaneous, and it was a scroller or a fighting scroller where you basically had people going left to right along this kind of two-dimensional top-down view, and you're just brawling. So technically it's a scrawling brawler or a brawler. There are other brawler games like Streets of Rage, you know, the Ninja Turtles game, the Simpsons game. These kind of side-scrolling brawlers were huge in the early 90s and were a way for, you know, IP owners like Marvel or Fox to sell their property and get some more money off of their investment. So video games are great. They're a lot of fun for us, and they make properties money. So anywho, we see Mojo come in. So Mojo is a great character from the comics who is the ruler of Mojoverse, which is kind of like an alternate dimension where Mojo is basically a god emperor who runs his reality like it's a giant nonstop 24/7 reality TV show. So in the original X-Men cartoon, Mojo was constantly kidnapping the X-Men and putting them through a grinder of onslaughts of, you know, robots and other villains and airing it live like a reality show, like kind of like a Coliseum. You know, they're just kind of fighting and he's, you know, he has it on there. Some funny parts in this where Jubilee is like, have you been dieting? Because Mojo's usually, you know, quite obese. And in this, he's very emaciated. But Mojo is a mutant who feeds on basically ratings or attention. And, you know, he's basically cybernetically augmented himself, so he doesn't need to sleep. He doesn't need to eat. He doesn't need to go to the bathroom. He can just basically live in this kind of, you know, walking, you know, chair and kind of just constantly watch and control things. He's like the ultimate control freak, and you can see that these metal tendrils are literally pulling his eyelids to maintain them as being open, which is a nod to what happened to one of the characters in A Clockwork Orange. So that's, you know, pop culture. We see Mojo, and Mojo is explaining to these two characters that they are stuck in a video game. Oh, wow, it's like, you know, augmented reality, but real. You know, wow, isn't it cool? If you die in the video game, you die in real life. I mean, we know we've seen these tropes. But it is fun when you get to see, like, the pixel art mixing in with the hand-drawn animation, you know, and we see this cool kind of character select sequencing, very similar to arcade games. Some of the art elements behind Jubilee and Roberto are evocative of major X-Men storylines like Days of Future Past, which we see those characters kind of scratched out behind a Jubilee and Roberto. Well, that's actually a part of the comics from a future where some of the characters are literally killed and, you know, human beings are putting that up to say, haha, we killed off half the X-Men. It's pretty morbid, but in this instance, they're just video game characters. You know, and the Sentinel designs and the street designs, these are all evocative of this, again, I was saying earlier, epic brawler, side-scroller, four-person arcade game, X-Men, which is just a great game. And even some of the two-dimensional designs that we see as Jubilee and Roberto going through the different stages. So stage two, the Savage Land. Like, these characters that they're fighting with the, you know, little jean shorts that are all ripped, they kind of look like Sauron, but not really. That was from that old school video game. So, like, you know, kudos to whoever designed this based off the OG video game, because it looks, and the sound and the pixel animation, it looks a lot better than that video game, but all the Sentinels and the way they're colored, and yes, in stage two of that 90s video game arcade, they do fight in the Savage Land. So very interesting. I mean, there's so many again, this is like Easter egg galore. So as much as I'm like, you know, this is really not evolving the story at all, and it's kind of just, you know, showing us something for entertainment value alone, there's a lot of Easter eggs, and it's a lot of fun. So we see some other fan favorite characters, Spiral, one of my favorite characters, who is Mojo's major domo, someone who is basically at Mojo's beck and call, who also is just always frustrated with Mojo. I think there's some kind of dependent relationship, i.e. Mojo has like a kill switch on Spiral. But Spiral is a character who can essentially teleport herself and other people through dimensions. She's very gifted, great fighter, very, very, mindful of strategy and tactics, very intelligent. I've always loved Spiral as a character, and it's nice to see her and, you know, to see what happens at the end of this little scenario. So as we go ahead, we see other stages that are represented from this 90s X-Men game, like Asteroid M. Like, that was another stage in the game. And then they're walking around these corridors, and yeah, it just looks like they literally took this OG arcade game and kind of did a hand-drawn animation behind it, like all the echoes and all. This is very, very, very well done and very creative. I was very impressed with what they were able to do, because you're essentially referencing a property that predates not only the 90s original X-Men show, but this show. So very impressive, even having Magneto be the last bad guy you fight, which is, yes, true. And he was very difficult. So I kind of love the self-referential. And then, yes, after, you know, Roberto gets the, you know, extra life, which for me, I think is actually hearkening to one of my favorite comics and one of my favorite comic book-based films, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I really think this was definitely a Scott Pilgrim versus the World nod when they find that extra life and he just kind of pushes it on him and he wakes up. Very Scott Pilgrim. If you haven't seen that movie, you got to see it. I love that movie. And so they beat Mojo. They work with, you know, this version of Jubilee, who's basically a clone kind of, or like a, you know, an augmented digital creation of Jubilee, who's been living in this video game beta environment for, I'm assuming, decades of her time. So old Jubes teams up with new Jubes, and they take out Mojo in a giant extravaganza of bright lights and colors. So fun. You know, all the animation, all the sound effects, so fun. You know, and then, you know, at the end, they get sucked back out of the Matrix, out of the video game. You see the melted console there, that Sega Genesis-looking console, all kind of melted, you know, very fun, you know, and they're out, and he's like, oh, we should take risks, and they just start making out. Love it. Love it. Hey, you know, video games are a great way to connect with your friends, with peers, with romantic partners. Nothing more fun than playing a video game with someone you love. You know, so that was a cool little vignette. And then, wow, do we change tone. Like life, death, like this, you know, this episode that's kind of half in this installment of the 97 series. Wow. I mean, the animation design, the tonality, the pace, everything is so different than what we just saw. It's almost like the creators of the series wanted to have us focus on this sequence. And the first part, that whole nostalgia trip, was kind of just like a bait. Like, here's some candy. Oh, by the way, we want you to read, Tolstoy. So, you know, this life death part one, very deep, very well animated, very thoughtfully developed. We see Aurora and we see Forge having this kind of moment montage of them, you know, learning about each other, and obviously they've been spending a lot of time together. And this is based on a comic history. So Forge and Storm have a relationship, a very tumultuous relationship in the comics. They are both people who have a physical and emotional past together. And it is fraught with a lot of lies, mainly on the part of Forge. You know, so this all makes sense. And, you know, I applaud the showrunners for going there and having a very adult and a very contemplative piece to what has been up to this point in this episode, very plucky and, you know, Saturday morning cartoon. This Life Death Part One is not Saturday morning cartoon. You know, there's probably people who are watching, you know, episode four, and when they get to Life Death, they're almost like, whoa, hey, what is this? What is this art house thing going on with all this amazing animation of what looks to be Wyoming or Arizona, probably Arizona, gorgeous, you know, very much, you know, bringing out visions of national parks that are in the Southwest and the North, you know, in the Midwest. Beautiful, like the horse riding scene, gorgeous, you know, very, very much, you know, a part of what I would say is a legacy of adult animation storytelling coming out of Japan, coming out of other countries, you know, out of Europe. There are ways to use animation in a way that is just as nuanced as in-person acting. And they do a great job with this. Like the design of Forge and Aurora, the design of her hair and, you know, and their interaction together in Forge's, you know, little man cave, you know, workshop. Like all of this is very, you know, it's hard to get all of the emotion and all the connection sandwiched into what is kind of like a 15-minute vignette being a short story. But you know, they do a good job. I mean, you know, you get to see these two people coming together, and we then assume based on how they interact and look at each other and compliment each other that there's some history. Maybe some time has passed from episode 3 to episode 4 regarding Aurora and Forge's relationship. You know, and we see Aurora struggling with, you know, Forge's tech not working. And she's calling for the wind and she's calling for a connection and it's just not there. Right? I mean, I got chills as someone who deals with a disability, a health issue that's kind of lifelong. You know, wouldn't I wish to just will it away and to have it not be a factor in my life? You know, and just racked with guilt when, like, you know, let's say I was subject to an experimental cure, it didn't fix it. And I'm still dealing with, like, these are things people deal with. And, you know, Storm is a representation not only of a human being with fragility and with grace and depth, but of suffering, of what it's like to be so close to regaining something you've lost and then to fall short. I mean, you could say anyone dealing with cancer, dealing with an injury, right? And being almost there and then just not getting there. It's devastating. And so I think this is some of the best animation of the entire property of the X-Men that I've seen. Just this one vignette, Life Death Part 1. I loved this vignette. Just Aurora's reactions and the ability to have artists convey that, and her tears seem real. Right, and her physicality seems genuine, and it's an anime. Like, it's the voice acting, is the, you know, how they're zooming the camera and panning and tilting. I mean, I loved this. All the shot sequencing was excellent, just excellent. This whole section. I mean, like, I almost feel bad that this couldn't have been its own episode. You know, I liked the whole Motendo thing, but this is artful here. And, you know, I kind of worry that are people going to just skip over it because it's too thought-provoking. But, like, it's really well done. I really enjoyed Life Death Part 1. And we do get to see some other kind of Easter eggs here. Like, if we go into Forge's lair, we see Forge kind of connecting with some characters. One of them kind of on the bottom right corner of this montage looks a little bit like the human Nimrod evolution, who's responsible for killing a lot of mutants. I think his name is like Bastion or something, but he's like a horrible character. Basically, he's an evolved version of Nimrod. We kind of see one arm hugging Forge in this picture. And then on the left, we see X-Force, right? We see Wolfsbane. We see Polaris or Lorna Dane. We see Havoc, who's Scott Summers' younger brother. We see Strong Guy, really cool character, and then we see Jamie Madrox as Multiple Man, and Forge. So yes, Forge was a part of a superhero team composed of mutants, which we did see if we watched the original series. You know, Forge was introduced in the original 90s series as a part of X-Force, right? It's almost like a counterpart to the X-Men team, you know, based on the West Coast. So very, very interesting. And we do see in the opening title sequence of this episode hints of that animation and that episode, which is very, very interesting. So, you know, long story short, Ororo is struggling with a couple of things, one being Forge's hidden truth that he worked on Sentinel tech and a mutant dampening tech. And he never told her that kind of he's doing this for her as a way of reconciling his past. And it's complicated because he also has feelings for her. And I'm assuming she him with the way that she looks at him at like frame 2355. Like, you know, there's chemistry going on there. And the way they animate it is very well done. And she leaves, and she goes and runs away on a horse, and then some demon thing kind of grabs her. And I don't know who this demon thing is. I can only assume it's the Shadow King. And that's just my assumption. Because I don't know what other demon characters look kind of like this and have this kind of ability. So the Shadow King is a super powerful telepath who basically can control people's minds, like Professor Xavier, but he's evil. And, you know, he's got kind of red eyes when he manifests his power, so I'm thinking this could be some version of the Shadow King in some way. You know, but it does bite Forge and inject Forge with some kind of, like, poison. So I don't know what that is, but it's definitely something that lives on a psychic plane. It's definitely something that seems to live in a different plane of existence, like a different reality. You know, when it grabs Ororo, it's talking to her in like a river of blood where all these trees are on fire. Well, I didn't see any trees in their surrounding. And if those were Joshua trees, which they look to be Joshua trees, I don't know if I saw them when they were riding across the fields. So it's not really in keeping with the area that they were actually in. If you're kind of looking at, you know, Ororo kind of running away, I didn't see any Joshua trees. Yeah, I just kind of see the plains. I think they're in the Midwest. But when she grabs Ororo and takes her into this hellscape, we see either Joshua trees or some African-style tree in the background. It's a very different, completely different area, which I think is in the parlance of Ororo's mind. So I really think this character is the Shadow King. And if it is the Shadow King does have a history with Ororo. The Shadow King used Ororo as a child in the comics to do basically his bidding when the Shadow King was operating out of Egypt. And, you know, Ororo was kind of like a slave, a mind slave to this entity who at the time was alive. I think his name was Amal Farouk, the Shadow King, before Xavier kind of lobotomized Farouk and kind of separated Farouk's mind from his body permanently. Anyways, that's a lot of a deep cut. But I did enjoy this episode. I think I enjoyed Life Death Part 1 much more than Mojo Nintendo, whatever. And it's too bad that Life Death Part 1 was only like 12 minutes long, to be exact. It's about 12 minutes long, the second part of this episode. And the first part was 18 minutes. So, you know, they've given a lot more time to Motendo. And, you know, this whole Life Death Part 1 was given like 12 minutes. Which, again, is there a limitation on episodes? Are there demands on trying to really weave this narrative into something within a time frame? I don't know. But, you know, I like what I see, and so far I find it interesting. But we'll see what happens for next episode, and who knows, maybe it'll be another two-parter. But until next time, keep it classic.